This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in French Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Roxanne Penchassi. My guest in this episode is Sarah Horowitz, the author of The Red Widow, The Scandal That Shook Paris and the Woman Behind It All. And the book was published by Sourcebooks in 2022. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you. I'm so thrilled to be on the podcast after listening to it for years.
Oh, that's really nice to hear. I always love learning that people who I get to speak to have listened in the past, and I'm super excited to talk with you in general and especially about this book. Sarah, I always ask people, how did you get interested in France, French studies, French history?
Yeah, so I think it's probably like a fair number of other folks who do French history. It was a language I learned in junior high and high school because it was what was offered. And then when I got into college, I continued. And when I was writing research papers, I felt so excited that I could do primary source research in the original language. It was sort of like I felt like I had access to the sort of special secret world, which, I mean, of course, did not have special access to, right? There are like many, many places where people speak French. But in the context of, right, a kind of college in the US, it felt really exciting to be able to kind of do that research. And so I just kept going with French history as the kind of what I would default to whenever I had a research project or anything like that. And so, yeah, that was it. And, you know, I also kind of fell in love with the culture, and going to Paris was really exciting. And it seemed like a kind of this like new place to discover.
And this truly fascinating, completely bananas story. I'm sure everybody asks you this, like, how did you stumble upon this?
Yeah, so it really was a little bit of, like, serendipity. I think in 2013, I was on a tour of Père Lachaise Cemetery, and our tour guide was taking us along, and we passed the tomb of Félix Faure, who was president of France in the 1890s. And our tour guide, you know, he's French, so like what do the French know about Félix Faure? They know how he died, which is he died in the arms of his mistress. And then the tour guide was like, that's not even the wildest part, and said that the mistress's husband and mother had been murdered and that she was put on trial. And I kind of was like, is this really true? Because this sounds like a very like French politician urban legend. But then I started to look around, and I was really interested in scandals. A lot of my favorite works are basically scandals, right? If sort of, you know, the kind of absolutely classic Return of Martin Guerre, or The Trial of Madame Caillot. And so I thought these were like really fascinating places where kind of private life spilled into public life and their discussions of gender and sexuality and taboos. And so then I was researching it as like, oh, you know, maybe this is like kind of interesting. Maybe it'll be part of a larger book. And the more I kept researching, I just kept finding more and more. And there was finally this moment where I was in the archives and I was like, this is unbelievable. Like, I'm having trouble just the kind of sheer wildness of what is going on was so much for me. And so finally I was like, okay, I have to do it. Like, this is a book on its own.
It's kind of an amazing story. And well, let's give the sort of bigger picture, the quick summary for people of who the book is focused on, the woman behind it all. So I know that the whole book is an exploration of her story and all this stuff, but can you give us have you got that down now?
I do. I have it down. So her name is Marguerite Stenahl. She's commonly called Meg by her friends and her family members. She's born in 1869 to a bourgeois family of industrialists in eastern France. When she's 20, she marries Adolf Stenahl, who is her 19 years older than her and is a painter. She goes to live in Paris with him. And she's not very happy with their marriage for a variety of reasons, and so sets off on a series of affairs with prominent men, many of whom are powerful individuals, particularly in the French judiciary. And the deal is that they will buy one of her husband's paintings and she will sleep with them.
Okay.
And potentially give her more money over the course of their affair. And then she's very famous because she had this 2-year-long relationship with Félix Faure in the 1890s. And he, in fact, died of a stroke that he had during one of their assignations. And then she sort of fades from the limelight a little bit for a batch of years. And then in 1908, her husband and mother are found murdered in their home. And she is the only survivor and the only witness. And she tells this series of absolutely absurd, ridiculous lies about what she saw. And then finally, after this very long investigation and sort of things blowing up in the media, after 6 months, she is arrested. And then in November 1909, she is tried for the murders and acquitted at the end of the trial.
Okay, so you said that you heard about this story. I feel like I didn't have that tour guide in Ballast Cemetery. I don't remember that particular story, but you know, you started with that kind of version of the story, and then you went and dug around some more and got more and more engrossed in this, in the twists and turns of all of this. What could you interact with that we might call a secondary source when you started this project? Was there stuff for you to work with?
Yeah, so the real kind of scholarly work that's been done on her is by Benjamin Martin, and it's a chapter in his book, The Hypocrisy of Justice. And it's sort of three trial scandals surrounding like kind of women in the Belle Epoque, and she was one of them. And so it's a really good work. He's a legal historian, so approaches it from that angle.
Yeah.
And then it's a fairly famous case in France, and so there's certainly books on it. Many of them are, I would say, not entirely what we would call absolutely 100% rock solid research.
Okay.
You know, as a sort of in the true crime, although some of them are quite good and some of them are quite reliable, but this was really certainly the first kind of scholarly book length work on her that I knew of.
Going in, was there also like methodologically or interpretively in terms of your approach, like things that you wanted to get at that St. Martin or some of these other authors hadn't explored? So that the depth of research, the length, all of that, but then also did you have particular approaches you wanted to bring to bear on Meg's story?
Yeah, I mean, I really wanted to talk about it in terms of the kind of norms of gender and sexuality at the time. Mm-hmm. And that was just not something that had been discussed at all. Many of the authors, particularly some of the kind of older works on her in France, it's this sort of combination of loving the salacious parts of her story, but also a distaste for her. And like, there are reasons to not like her, but I felt that there was also sometimes in some of those works, a kind of misogyny. And then also particularly around her husband's relationships with men, a kind of homophobia. And so I wanted to place her in this kind of cultural context that I didn't think she had been placed in. And also, you know, kind of treat her with a somewhat different eye. Like, I wasn't going to condemn her because she was having sex outside of marriage.
Right.
And I thought that there had been this sort of laughing, dislike of her. And again, there are, like, real reasons to dislike her, but I thought that maybe her affairs weren't necessarily those reasons.
It's interesting because when I was reading the book, I was developing my own relationship to her and to her, the twists and turns of her story. And I kept thinking about that and wanting to ask you about this when we spoke. I don't do biography by any stretch of the imagination. I don't live with single figures or even a family or something like that in the work that I do. And so I just wonder, like how would you characterize your relationship? If you want to lie down on a couch, you can do that right now. While we're talking, just get comfy. And yeah, tell me about your relationship to Meg.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think she's a terrible person, right?
Okay. Tell me what you really think.
Right, exactly. Like, she was very cruel to those around her. She was super anti-Semitic. She put vulnerable individuals in danger. She had no problem kind of throwing people under the bus to do what she could to save her own skin. There are all sorts of reasons why I think she's a terrible person. I was always fascinated by her.
Yeah.
And I also always thought that there are these moments that where I'm intensely sympathetic to her. Like, she's 21, I think, and she's just moved to Paris with her husband. And she knows instantly that the marriage is a failure and she's unhappy and that it just wasn't what she wanted. And I just, you know, I think we've all had those moments where we've just been disappointed. And, like, how do we remake our lives in the face of disappointment? And so I felt like kind of that was this thing that I could draw on, this thing, place where I was very sympathetic to her. And then I was actually writing a lot of the manuscript during the 2020-2021 academic year. I was on a very, very lucky to have a long-planned writing sabbatical for that year, and it just happened to be the sort of worst year to be teaching. And I think that, you know, this was someone, Meg was someone, she just broke all the rules. And when I think about the kind of height of the pandemic, I think about how it was this period when there are just so many new rules that we had to learn, like social distancing, like masking, like exposure times, like whether we were a danger to our loved ones or not, and, you know, where we could go, what was safe, wasn't safe, and all these things. And, you know, like, of course, I'm like, yes, I want to keep myself and my loved ones safe. But there's also, you know, always that kind of like shadow side of me. It's like, yeah, let's just go into a grocery store and like rip off our mask and breathe. And I sort of felt that like she could allow me to engage with that side of myself who, like, even though I am very kind of rule following, still has the kind of like the enthusiasm about like how fun it must be to break the rules.
That's super interesting, Sarah. Like, I didn't know the details of, I mean, I knew when the book came out, and so you kind of work back from there about when people are writing things and stuff, but I hadn't really thought about that, and it's totally fascinating to me that there could be this kind of connection between writing in the context of the pandemic. Like, I've talked to other authors in the last couple of years who were doing that kind of work during this intense, difficult time, And it really, I mean, maybe we'll be able to look back on this period of publications and things in it and other things, other cultural and other projects and products that they really shape the way that we do things, maybe in surprising ways sometimes.
Yeah, definitely.
So you mentioned that when you got into the archives and started to dig around, you were just in awe of the story and the things that you found. Can you tell us a little bit about the range of materials that you're working with in this project, what you did find, what kinds of things, what types of sources you accessed, both to get at perspectives on Meg, but also somewhat to get at her kind of inner life, thoughts, whatever, as much as you could in a project like this?
Yeah, so there are three sets of sources that I had. One was her memoirs, which they were ghostwritten, although clearly with a great deal of collaboration from her. Mm-hmm. And they were ghostwritten by one of her lovers. That's been really kind of what a lot of the people to have written on her have relied on. And the other was newspaper accounts. The case was in the news, you know, kind of on and off for about 18 months. Very often front page news. And so there were just kind of endless retellings of the story, you know, kind of new details coming out. And those also, a lot of other writers had looked at them. I couldn't really find other works that had relied on the third source base I was using, which is the police's investigative file and the Parisian police prefecture's archives. And this was the investigation into the murder case, so the murder of Meg's husband and mother. And that was in some ways the kind of most interesting to me, partly because there's all sorts of things that like really never made it out into public that were in that file. And partly because I could actually retrace what the police had done and had not done. And so as I was looking at that, it was really clear that in the 6 months following the murders, the police's main concern was to shield her from any scrutiny. And to shield her kind of powerful, wealthy friends and lovers from scrutiny. So there are these, you know, long documents where they're interviewing all these people, former servants, neighbors, but they never really look at any of her kind of powerful lovers. And so that was interesting to me. Like, what are they not doing?
Mm-hmm.
And then as Meg is working with the police, she's spinning out these kind of versions of the murder and she keeps changing her story. And so it's also interesting to me to see the police following along with what were essentially kind of absurd stories that she were telling that, like, mm-hmm. you know, anyone could just be like, yeah, that cannot be what happened. But just how seriously they were following up on those possibilities, you know, and I sort of thought, like, look, it's not as if I am, like, you know, smarter than any of these, right, police officials. It's they're doing this because of the sense of trying to protect her.
Okay, so kind of a tangent from that is just straight up, Sarah, are you a fan of true crime?
Yes.
Like, did you read true crime before this project? Were you like,
yes.
Oh, you were? Okay.
Yeah.
Do you think, like, that's what drew you to this project? I guess the reason I'm asking is because reading this book, it's such a compelling read. Your mode of writing, and I want to figure out some ways for us to talk about this and for you to tell us a little bit about your writing process, because I kept thinking about it as I was reading the book. Like, it's familiar to me in some ways, right? From that genre, which I'm not, you know, an avid reader of, but I've read some things, you know, and then of course, film and television kind of versions of those types of stories. So you've got it down. Like, I mean, you're still a historian and a scholar and an academic, like you kind of move back and forth between this, you know, page turner narrative and twists and turns of plot and stuff, and then reminding us when there's a detail about her or family or various aspects of her life and the people she encounters of a broader context. So for example, if you're talking about divorce, then you'll kind of pan out to, like, and this is how people thought about divorce in the Third Republic. And I know you've read Ed Berenson and, you know, read about divorce in that context, and that's how you're kind of providing that for people. But yeah, I, as I was reading it, I thought, Were you a true crime writer all along, and this was your, like, historian's opportunity to realize that?
So I have enjoyed, like, a lot of stuff in true crime. I'm not super, super devoted.
Right.
But I do enjoy it. And I think it's more that the reason I'm a historian is because I really like the messiness of other people's lives. And, you know, it's like just sort of like, at a certain level, cultural history is sometimes just like old gossip. Right. And so it was really, I've always been drawn to kind of sources about particular individuals and their social worlds. And so I think that's sort of what drew me to the profession. It's actually, it's interesting. Like, I think I'm in a department of people who, you know, many of us have that sort of same interest in these kind of juicy scandals, these cases, like, right? We sort of like figuring out other people's lives, and we just do it at some sort of chronological remove.
And so that, like, matches, like, some contemporary interests that you have in what's going on politically or culturally.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
So the book is beautiful.
Thank you.
And it's, you know, the marketing of it, everything about it says, like, I know who you are. I know what your background is. I know what your training is. I know what went into this book, but everything about it says anybody can pick up this book and read it. And I am so fascinated by and in admiration of that.
Thank you.
How did that process unfold? Like, it isn't a traditional historical monograph in so many ways. And I hope you know what I mean when I say that. I'm sure.
Yes.
And that seems real deliberate. So I'm very curious. I think a lot of listeners would be interested to know, like, how people get to write a book in this way, want to write a book in this way, and how that kind of unfolds.
So when I was first thinking about this book, I had imagined it as a very traditional history monograph. It was going to be narrative because there is a fairly clear narrative. But I had the 6 chapters planned. I had certain themes planned. But as I kept working on it, people would ask me what the story was about. And they're like, this is totally bananas. Have you thought of writing for a kind of wider audience? And it was really, I couldn't figure out what I wanted for a really long time. And so I was had about a draft of about 2/3 of the material. And so finally I was like, all right, I'm just going to decide to see if I can get interest in a trade press in it. And that will make my decision easier because then I'll know how to write it.
Sure. Yeah.
And so that's what I decided. But I'm so gratified to hear that it works both for historians and for non-historians. You know, I love assigning like sort of micro histories in my classes. My students respond to them so well. So I thought, like, why not add one more to the pile? But I also wanted this to be something that kind of wasn't going to be really off-putting for, like, my peers and colleagues and friends who are historians.
Right. No, I think it's quite remarkable the way you do it, because you'll sort of be moving along telling us a little bit about, like, the details of her upbringing or something, and then you'll kind of move towards these broader contextual things that and I can't speak for all the historians who read the book, but when I was reading, I found that really impressive because I knew what you were zooming out to, you know, and trying to incorporate, like, okay, if we're going to talk about this woman and her circumstances, it's important for my reader to know that these were the bourgeois values of this moment, or, you know, these were the class issues of this period. And when you are zooming out, I looked at your notes, but I, even without looking at your notes, like, I could kind of anticipate, like, some, at least, of the things you would gesture at, but you figured out a way to do that without it being loaded down with historiography. And not that I have great respect for people who get into the historiography in detail, but you've somehow managed. And so, yeah, that challenge, I guess I applaud it, but I also, like, what were some of the challenges of writing in this way differently from, you know, that more maybe traditional academic mode or style?
Yeah, it's so I was really lucky in that I had two great editors at Sourcebooks who really helped me make the switch. Uh-huh. And so they recommended some narrative nonfiction for me that they thought would kind of teach me how to do it. Uh-huh. And so one of the things that I think you were alluding to was like they're sort of here's what happened, here's the story, and then you zoom out and say, and here's the larger context. Whereas, uh-huh. you know, the way we are taught to work is you do it the other way, right? You're talking about the larger historical context and you sort of zoom in on a particular person or event or phenomenon. So kind of flipping that, so you didn't lose the reader there because they're like, oh my gosh, I'm so bored, right? or hopefully you don't lose the reader. They also talked about kind of chapters of 3,000 to 4,000 words in length, ending often on a cliffhanger, mm-hmm. And also the kind of really much more than I would have for a scholarly audience, building up character, building up secondary characters, building up relationships, and presenting, like, there are a lot of times where you hear Meg's voice, right? It's like, this is what she wrote in her memoirs, or this is what she said. And I was really, really lucky because the case was so closely covered by journalists that in a lot of cases, I had dialogue, mm-hmm. right? Like, I have the words she said to a detective. I have the kind of words she said in an interview. And so I could give that voice. But it is, I think the big thing is, you know, as historians, we are really taught to show our work, right? Mm-hmm. Show who we're indebted to, show who we're in conversation with, show the kind of like world we're coming from. And for a trade audience, it's really about kind of hiding the work, mm-hmm. right? So like, if you want to read about degeneration in late 19th century France, like you would have to go to the footnotes, mm-hmm. Right? And sort of kind of condensing it so it's really just what the reader needs to understand what's happening, but not necessarily much more.
So do you feel like now that you've done a book like this, what do you think? Like, is this the way you want to go? It seems like it would be fun, super challenging. Like, I don't have any confidence that I could pull something like this off. But yeah, do you feel like this is the mode you want to write in?
I think it would really depend on the project I end up doing next. And so I think it would be kind of, is that something that fits the project or not?
Right.
Not really kind of wedded either way. Mm. But I had a tremendous amount of fun writing the book at times, not all times.
So sure.
It's like, you know, okay, ladies, stop lying. but I had a lot of fun writing it. And I think also, you know, like a lot of people in academia, like I just grew up really loving to read. And so there was something about kind of recapturing that joy in a kind of language and in reading and writing that I think often, right, sort of academia, like kind of discourages, shall we say. And so I really loved that ability to kind of get joy in like just the process of writing. And to think also like what would please the reader, right? Like what would make it fun for them? That being said, you know, there are times when I was like, wow, like this would be so much easier if I could write for a scholarly audience where, right, I sort of didn't have to compress certain discussions. And there's also things that I thought were really interesting and maybe like spent a lot of time researching that just didn't make it into the book. Or made it into the book, like, just like a sort of, you know, a sentence. Whereas in like a kind of different version of the book, they would have been expanded. Because it just seemed like kind of interesting about the culture of the time, but not really central to the narrative. Mm. And so there was, I definitely had this feeling of like, there's this having to kind of like, constantly follow a narrative. It's wonderful in some ways and it's so constraining in others because again we're trained to kind of try and understand all the dimensions, is, right? Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. how are people at the time responding? Why are they interested in this case? You know, what do they see from it? What messages do they take? And that's not really something that I had the sense that a trade readership would really want to know.
That's really, really interesting. And it sort of naturally makes me want to shift us towards thinking about the arguments that the book makes, right? Because I think it is doing that in the midst of this different mode of writing and like different aims in terms of a wider readership. So let's just start with, I'm just picking something. Let's start with gender and sexuality. Why not? What did you learn researching Meg and this story, this scandal, this affair, in terms of, you know, gender and sexuality within this period? And what do you want readers to take away from the story, from Meg's story, in terms of their understanding of gender and sexuality in this, like, end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century era in France? Let's just keep it to France.
Yeah. So I think, you know, the kind of lens that I was looking at it, particularly in the first third of the book, which is really up to the point of the murders, is the twin poles of, like, respectability and scandal.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And Meg was really interesting because she spent her entire life navigating those. I mean, even in her childhood, she was the product of a quite scandalous marriage. And so she's always navigating these, and the kind of way in which respectability would constrain her, but also the way in which, you know, she's sort of sometimes using scandal to her benefit, to really, you know, after Felix Frol dies, to kind of market herself as this, like, exceptional lover who will give you really exciting thrills. And so it was very interesting for me to think about, like, kind of what are the constraints on a woman's life? And these moments when it shifts, like when she marries, you know, why does she not get divorced? She's in this marriage that she doesn't like. She has grounds for a divorce very early on. But the fact that that was really scandalous, and much more scandalous than her having affairs for money.
Right.
So that's the kind of this sort of these that she's always playing between these two. And is very canny about kind of appealing to both at the same time to market herself in certain ways.
Mm.
And then the other, which I think is like more of a kind of historiographical argument, is, right, if we sort of think about Michel Foucault's ideas about power and sexuality and knowledge, this idea that knowledge of sexuality, knowledge of sexual behavior gives, right, kind of like is a form of power.
Mm.
And so that's obviously true, right? I'm not, like,
yeah,
disputing that. But I think they're, like, sort of, like, things that then proceed from that, which I wanted to explore in this book. So one is that also means that, like, silence about sexual behavior, right, ability to maintain your privacy, is also a form of power.
Mm-hmm.
That's a sign that you are in the elite, that you have this kind of, you know, shroud of secrecy, or of privacy that you get to maintain around your behavior. And then also, like, thinking about this, it's like, okay, well, what do scandals do in this kind of very hierarchical, restratified world of the late 19th and early 20th century? Is they move, right, kind of elite secrets out into the public. So they democratize knowledge. Right. And this is something that, like, comes in part from, like, Aria Dute's work on scandal, which I thought was really helpful, as well as, like, the kind of many works on, like, sort of scandals and as these kind of morality tales. And so, right, I was thinking, okay, as there are these moments when suddenly elite transgressions come into view, right, what that does is it democratizes knowledge. But it also allows the public to kind of question the kind of hierarchies of their society, right? So at the time, when Meg is put in prison, all her secrets come pouring out. So all her affairs, her relationship with Felix Frol, those had all just circulated as rumor and gossip for many years. And there's this real kind of outcry of, like, sort of in pairs of like, these are people who say that they are so well behaved, right? That the bourgeoisie is constantly saying that they're these kind of moral guardians of society. And look what they're doing behind closed doors, right? And are they entitled to power? And so I thought this was also like a way to think about what's happening in our own world. You know, we live in this era where there's just been like decades of revelations about the transgressions of powerful individuals. You know, some of them, I think, like, it's just like, oh, this, you know, random politician had an affair, like, whatever, that's, you know, like, private business. But some of them, I think, like, really, really troubling stuff. And I started working on this book a few years after Dominique Strauss-Kahn was arrested. And the kind of ways in which scandals and these revelations about the kind of transgressions of powerful figures can lead to mobilizations around questions of, right, sort of gender, around class, around race, and sort of really allow us to kind of challenge certain power hierarchies.
Do you feel like you're able in the book, Sarah, to get at, like, we know about the flurry of interest in the different moments of her story and her life at, you know, all of the different types of versions of events flying around and speculation and rumor. And I mean, rumors and gossip are like the sort of spine of her entire existence, it seems, from the time she's really young, from the time Meg is really young. So do you feel like you have a sense coming out of this project of, and that you've gotten at as much as you could and wanted to, of how her story is received, not just by the press that's like churning out rumors and scandals because that's how they make their living, but by the wider French society?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something that were I writing the book for a scholarly audience, I would have been able to explore more because there was a lot of things I sort of thought were interesting but didn't really feel I could follow up on.
Yeah.
Then I think one of the things that was fascinating to me, which did make it into the book, is that in many instances, you know, the public becomes really, really sympathetic and really kind of starts to like her, admire her, treat her as a sort of exciting sexual celebrity in ways that I think if the case were to have happened, you know, in 2023, I think there would be a lot more moral condemnation of her. And people often, like, readers were very surprised that, you know, she was kind of popular. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that she's the sort of sexual celebrity who kind of fits certain narratives at the time of what it means to be a French woman, right? Which is you're very sexy, you're very charming, you're very attuned to male desire. You're maybe not the most moral individual, but you're really fun. Right. And I think she certainly kind of, that's how she marketed herself. She does have an international clientele. When she's married and having like affairs for money. Uh-huh. But it also was kind of clear in the sort of responses to her that there was this sort of sense of like, she's one of these like great French women who is maybe not super ethical, but like, no, she is fun. So that's kind of true in the book, but there was a lot of like dimensions of that I didn't feel like I could really talk about,
right.
And that in a different book I would have talked about the sort of some of the particular ways in which I think she conforms to, right, like certain kind of expectations about what it means to be really sexy.
I guess I could have asked you about this earlier when I asked you about true crime, but the book is also like a criminal investigation, right? Into this to this scandal and you're following the criminal investigation, I guess I have a couple of questions along those lines. Like, to what extent did you feel like you were conducting your own investigation of the, I know you can't get at the truth of the story, but I could imagine getting kind of sucked into that sort of forensic investigative detective work and seeing yourself as a historian as doing that kind of thing. So I wonder about that. And then, yeah, you know, what you think this affair, how it illuminates those kinds of connections in early 20th century France, the centrality of certain ways of thinking about crime and police and evidence and detective work and the wider political ramifications of all of that.
Yeah, those are great questions. So I think in terms of me being a detective, I felt like I was a meta detective, I guess, which is that I never really was sort of like, I'm on the trail of the actual perpetrator. I'm going to figure out who did it.
Yeah, right.
Just didn't believe that was possible. But I did feel like my detective work was trying to figure out what the detectives were doing.
Yeah.
So it's actually, there are times when it was like really important for me to figure out what did they know and when did they know it, right? Because that helped me understand, oh, they know that Meg is lying. They know that she's telling a story that is completely improbable. And they have the evidence for that, but they're still helping her. And they're still helping her prove that story.
Mm-hmm.
So it did feel like kind of piecing something together. And I spent a summer. That's just like kind of what I did was like, okay, they know this then. And then they figured this out. And by this date, they've gotten this information.
Is there a board somewhere in your house with like like images and red thread and push pins and stuff? Like, is that, if I came over right now, would I find that somewhere in your house?
No, it was just all in my mind or in my notes or something like that. I should have done that. I should have had my, you know, my kind of murder board. I think to the kind of second question you were asking about these questions about police and crime and evidence is it was just so clear that the police felt that their job was to protect her. Mm. And that was their kind of primary responsibility for a really long time until eventually, you know, I think the authorities were just backed into a corner where they're like, listen, we can't do that anymore. Like she's made it impossible. And that at the same time, there was this real kind of willingness to put poor individuals in danger. So there's some stuff that didn't make it in the book, but like, pretty significant surveillance of one of her servants, but also they just are like, and maybe let's like go and ask about suspicious Jews. It was really kind of striking to me that this kind of sense that their duty it was very clear from the archival documents that their duty was not to find the truth, but was to uphold a version of of society, right? Which is that elites are not perpetrators; they are victims of crimes, and right, sort of poor people are perpetrators, and that they're sort of like were kind of constantly engaged in this process, even when like it's clear that that's just no one else believes them, and so. That was really interesting to me. And then, you know, I think in terms of the evidence and the kind of detection, it was so fascinating to me that the public, how they were participating in this process. And this is something that, again, I didn't have the space to really talk about it in the book, but there's these amazing stacks of letters to the police with notes and tips. And it's everything from like, my wife was similar. And I think, you know, like Meg has hysteria or like I'm a... grosser, and I think the cord that was found at the crime scene is a kind of the cord that was used, or right? Like, I was on the metro and I saw this, and I think it might be the murderers. And I was really fascinated by the way in which people were kind of inserting themselves into the story, as kind of actors, as people could like decode the signs of the city. And also, in some cases, it seemed clear that like people, you know, like they're living in Paris and maybe like, right, they're sort of going on the metro and they're walking and their lives are kind of very ordinary. The way that ordinary life is. But then they think, I see this thing and it's going to solve everything. So
right.
The kind of this like Sherlock Holmesing in a way.
Yeah.
Like was about the kind of drama of the city.
Yeah.
And this is right. I mean, sort of like very much drawing on Vanessa Schwartz's Spectacular Realities as this kind of participatory phenomenon of like how exciting everyday life could be.
Yeah, and I think to the extent that you get at this Meg's story and this affair as kind of case study and celebrity, like the fact that people, we think of that as a very contemporary, as in right now, kind of phenomenon, and that people talk about the novelty of it in the age of social media and online stuff. But the idea that in getting invested in the lives of celebrities and seeing connections between your everyday existence and their the twists and turns of their lives. And then, like you say, putting yourself in their stories by maybe finding a clue or having some kind of insight on their personality, like that kind of celebrities are celebrities because they're not like us, but stars are also just like us, right? Like, so I sort of feel like there's an early history of some of those things in the book too.
Oh, absolutely. And there's, I think, you know, Meg is interesting because on the one hand, she's having affairs with these like really powerful men, but she lives in a very ordinary neighborhood in Paris. She's on the 15th in a kind of neighborhood of like workshops and artist studios. And I think she also basically like solicits one of her lovers on the metro. And I think there's this sort of feeling of like she is sort of proof of like the celebrity who is so excited and has access to all these halls of power, but is also really accessible, and that you might actually see her on the street.
Yeah, I think that whole urban history of this project is really, really fascinating. It's like it's the women behind it all, but yeah, it's the scandal that shook Paris, and I'm sure people were paying attention to the scandal elsewhere, but the way the city plays a role in the story is really interesting, even like before she comes, right? Like her arrival in Paris is part of her story, and then I am getting these kinds of Sherlock Holmesy visuals with like, and I know that this story has made its way into, you know, visualizations. Like there's at least that TV show, the French show that lives the story. And I don't know if there are there film versions of this story?
There's a TV movie, which is mainly about her relationship with the with Faure. It's not great. I mean, I think
right.
The actress in it is amazing. But it actually like sort of goes into the weird anti-Semitic territory. Yeah. And I was like, oh, not fantastic. And then I think there've been sort of there's like a TV movie in the 1970s. I actually had a kind of list of things I wanted to watch in Paris, but then that was scheduled for the summer of 2020.
Right.
Did not happen.
Of course. Well, maybe someone will, you know, take out an option on your book, Sarah, and we can see the movie based on The Red Widow. I would 100% go see that.
Oh my God. She is like a movie character.
Yeah, no, I could absolutely see that. And I think that's also a testament to the way you've written the book. It's like there are visuals even when there aren't visuals. And that was another thing I was going to ask you about, you know, the images, the visual history of this, the way you use images in the book, if there's anything you wanted to say about like the visual cultural part of the story and then how you, yeah, incorporated images in the book and thought about your use of images as, you know, illustration, sure, but any other thoughts you have on the visual side?
Yeah, I was really fascinated by the way she was presented in kind of various kind of the visual culture of the time. So like one of the images that really, really fascinated me, and unfortunately the press was just not able to reproduce it in color. It's a portrait of her by Vion Bonnat, who's a close friend of hers, and it was a portrait commissioned by Felix Faure. And it's really amazing because the ways it plays between kind of respectability and scandal. So she's, you know, kind of like very primly dressed in this light blue lacy dress. But she has a smile on her face. And, I look through kind of Bonnat's work, and that was clearly a marker of intimacy. And it also, it's something that the woman smiling was also, I think, a marker of someone who is a sex worker, like of a courtesan. And so that was really interesting to me about how she's presenting herself, and how, you know, her lover who was commissioning this portrait and wants her to be seen, wants to remember her by. And then I was really interested in the kind of way she was like clearly traded on the streets of Paris in postcards, in sort of newspapers, in magazines, that there, I think part of it was like an almost pornographic versions of her. There's one that's reproduced in the book, which is she's like topless, and she's presenting these like sort of high state officials with drinks. And it's sort of a reference to both her as a sex worker and then also to in like very kind of coded ways to the crime. But there were also other images which, you know, like in, I think, Le Matin, which is one of these like huge major mass circulation dailies, of her like almost naked in a bed tied up.
Oh, yeah. That image of her like at the scene of the murder is really intense. Like,
Yeah. And so I think the kind of this like voyeurism, this ability to kind of see this woman who really was a kind of mistress to an elite, and also the kind of that same play was kind of accessibility and like kind of remoteness, that with the scandal, what happens is all these images start circulating of her. And so, like, you know, if you can buy a postcard, you can have like a really sexy image of her.
It's totally fascinating to me how you bring all of these things together in the book. When I got to the afterword, where you really explore the question of how Meg might remind us of more contemporary scandals, issues, women, movements, like politics, these kinds of things. Like, the question that came up for me was, oh, like, inevitably, if I was writing a book like this in the present, I would be thinking and drawing on all kinds of images and scandals and things, and making those connections along the way. So how much do you feel like that shaped your writing of the book and your approach to Meg? And yeah, what do you want to remind us about in terms of how she's not a an early 20th century Anna Delvey? I don't know who else. Like, Anna Delvey comes to mind because I watched that series not long ago.
Yeah, I think she is kind of in that category of the lady scammer.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, someone who's very charismatic, very able to read people, to give them what they want, to sort of like skate by on lies that really aren't challenged. I think in ways that also speak to her whiteness, her status, and kind of uses those skills to rise in high society. And so I think that there's this kind of Anna Delvey-ness to her. And I think it's also, you know, like, I loved all the Anna Delvey kind of, you know, the show. With,
same.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think the kind of these stories about women who have all this gumption, like, there's something that's like really appealing to us, but it is also this, like, you know, girl boss gone wrong.
Yeah. It's also terrible, but like, I love it. Yeah.
Right. And so I think there was that. And then I think also, like, what is it that the kind of those scandals do, right? These scandals then allow us this peek into this world of kind of wealth, of privilege, the kind of rooms where decisions are made, like what it's like kind of being, right, like in like these sort of arenas of power, which are very inaccessible to us. Oh. Right. So thinking back about the Anna Delvey miniseries, and this is perhaps a reference that, you know, only people who will have seen the miniseries will get.
Those are the only listeners I'm speaking right. to in general. Exactly. Yeah.
There are all these scenes on yachts, right? Which is this area of, you know, kind of elite life that is completely inaccessible to us.
Right. Right.
Right. And so, like, I think similarly, what happens when Meg is arrested is that the public gets all this access into kind of what it was like in her salon, right? Like how she got patronage for friends and family members, right? The kind of all the kind of sources of preferment that she could get, you know, what, like, even sort of like what Felix Faure was like, you know, a lot of discussions of his genitalia. You know, I would spend these days being like, oh my gosh, I'm not sure I need to really, like, know this much about him. But, like, that's also kind of that voyeurism, I think, is part of a scandal, is, like, what, you know, what are these people who seem so remote, what do they kind of really like? What really motivates them?
Right.
Are they really as sort of august and magisterial, right, as we think they are? And I think, right, that would be the kind of Belle Epoque equivalent of the way that, like, Elizabeth Holmes or Anna Delvey plays, which is, are these people really as smart?
Right. I'll just put a link to a couple of informative, you know, tidbits about these people we're talking about in case there's anyone who wasn't completely bombarded by the explosion of cultural interest in these women. So, you know, the book is, I mean, I said it earlier, it's like beautiful and it's written for this wider audience and it's had a whole life since it came out. And I guess I wanted to just ask you, like, how's that been, you know, especially as an academic, being able to have conversations with people in all sorts of reading corners and interested in different aspects of the story? And yeah, anything you want to tell us about the life of the Red Widow and of Sarah Marwitz since the book came out?
So I was really sort of felt incredibly fortunate that I got to speak to a lot of audiences, librarians, booksellers, did like a mini kind of regional tour.
Amazing.
And it was really fun. And it was like one of the things that I think sometimes as academics, you know, there's some folks who have this real disdain for like a kind of general readership. But this was just like the kind of, I think, real sophistication of folks was so apparent that they had tons of questions about like sources and process and methodology that are like very similar to the ones that, you know, historians ask.
Yeah.
Right. So they weren't like invested in the historiography, but they were sort of like, okay, well, how did you evaluate all these complicated sources? And so that was really, really fun. And I really enjoyed it. And also, you know, talking to like readers and like librarians and booksellers, they're just like fascinating people. And also, you know, like on the front lines of a culture war. It was like really interesting to see what they were dealing with, right? Their perspective. It was at the same time like really exhausting because I do have a full-time job, right? And so it was like, you know, teaching and then would have to like get on a plane and teach my like class from a hotel room and then like fly back. And so that was, it was both like wonderful and absolutely exhausting.
Yeah. You'll find that, you know, if you ever go back to obscurity, my experience is that it's very restful, you know, just like writing things that a few people read. It's it's great over here.
I was thrilled when it was over. I mean, like, I had a great time, but I was just like, I just like need to just like watch television, you know, and like pet my dog and like you know, like, just be like a really normal individual. I'm also, you know, someone who, like, I have learned to overcome my shyness, but innately sort of shy. And so it's actually like a little bit nerve-wracking for me to be on in that way.
Oh, yeah. It's been really great to, I mean, I follow Sarah on Twitter. I'm going to continue to call it Twitter. But, you know, it's just been great to watch it unfold. And I think as a model for how we can do work that, yeah, reaches more people and shows people the value of doing historical research and writing in these ways and getting at some of these questions, I think it's fantastic. So congratulations on all of that, even though it does sound super exhausting. One last question, Sarah, and you can say nothing. I'm just being a normal person who watches television, but do you want to tell us anything about next project?
So I wish I knew.
I don't know. I have no idea.
This book just came out, like, not that long ago, so. Yeah, and I wanted to, so I finished the manuscript in, like, fall 2021. Right. So I've had, like, basically two summers. And I just wanted to, like, read all the stuff that I hadn't been able to read. And also, frankly, be a human being.
Yeah.
You know, who, like, wasn't on a deadline, wasn't on a schedule.
That is a great answer, and I think it's really important for you to say, but also for lots of people to hear, because I think we put an inordinate amount of pressure on ourselves to, like, you know, that we gotta, like, next, you know, like, before we're even done. So,
yeah.
I hope that being human and taking some time has been good, and that I'll get to talk to you in some way, shape, or form about whatever comes next for you. I just want to thank you so much, Sarah, for taking the time to speak with me about this really wonderful book.
Thank you. This has been such a pleasure.